This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, from a certain point of view, multiple points of view, dual timelines, and reader sympathies in speculative fiction.
This week, in advance to the episode, we're going to have to ask you to forgive us a little bit, because it's so hot. It's so hot that both of us are dying.
Our brains are boiling in our skulls.
Yes. I also just had a wisdom tooth taken out, so if I sound a bit funny, it's because my face is a bit chipmunk at the moment. So I'm slurring a tiny bit.
I think you're all right.
Thank you. I'm doing my best. So Jules, this week this was your suggestion. I know that I know a little bit about what prompted it, but sort of talk me through a little bit more.
Yeah, well, it was the dual timeline thing that sparked it off, and then I started thinking about multiple points of view and how, you know, one of the things we've discussed before is that everyone is the hero of their own story. So yeah. You could make the case that nobody is the hero of the overall story that includes all points of view. Mm-hmm. And then you have these great, huge, generally epic size worlds and novels whereby there are multiple points of view used. And why people would do that, because that's a lot of work as an author.
It is, yeah.
But it's also incredibly rewarding. And I suppose it's something that I'm dipping into at the moment myself, because I'm trying to put my unveiled collection, Dead Roads, together, which has many, many points of view in it from different characters. And in one respect, it's really easy because the characters are so alive for me that they're just telling me what's happening.
Yeah.
And I imagine if you haven't got well-rounded characters, then it would be quite difficult to put something together because you've got to start from the ground up in that case.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's also a case of, oh my God, well, this happens at the same time as this and the same time as this is happening. So I've got four stories that are kind of happening at the same time and they intersect at certain points, but not others. And it's like this massive, massive spider diagram in my head trying to get all the timelines to line up.
Well, since Jules and I basically decided that the Kestrel Saga and Unveiled are happening in the same world, I started putting together a timeline of when different books and different stories are actually happening. And I sent it to Jules. She said, can I update this? And I was like, of course you can, because I knew I hadn't put in any of the novellas or the short stories. And then she sent it back and it's just a spider web.
I looked at it and I thought, I feel I've taken over a bit here, but I'm sure Madeline's going to add some more Kestrel Saga stuff, so I'm not going to feel too bad.
Yeah, it started off as a kind of, all right, just so that I could get my head around it, so I was writing so I could say, right, at this point when they meet, this has happened and this has happened. But it is hard and things get, and you get muddled up because this very simple linear structure that you had suddenly kind of goes all over the place, especially if what happens is that for instance, just as an example, Emmeline in book four of Unveiled, that the course of book four, it takes over it's over the course of September to December.
Yeah.
And in between that time, there are two Kestrel Saga books.
Yeah. And a crossover story.
And a crossover, yeah.
So and Kestrel's been a very busy girl.
She doesn't get a break. She really doesn't get a break.
And it's like, I'm just doing one book here, Kestrel. What are you doing?
So, and then... in total contrast, you'll suddenly have this moment where there's a whole bunch of Unveiled stories between Kestrel books, and it's literally because just at certain points things go quiet for one person, but they don't necessarily go quiet for the other. And yeah. I think probably one of the best examples of multi point of view, the two best that I can think of. I would mention Six of Crows, but the thing about Six of Crows is that actually, at least for the first book, they are together right up in the beginning, and then they kind of split off.
Yeah, it's designed to give you multiple insights into the world rather than to show you characters doing different things in different places.
And whilst you do then get a little bit of that as they all kind of split off, it's mostly it's just actually it's interesting because it's you have these multiple characters so that you see multiple points of view of other characters
Yeah.
and different impressions, and I really really like that. But I think probably one of the best ones that we have to mention is of course A Song of Ice and Fire, and that's it's the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I've actually got that written in my notes, and it was one I was going to bring up too, so we are in agreement there.
We are in agreement. The thing I like about Game of Thrones, particularly the books, is that my God, you can really hate characters, but you strangely start to root for them when you're reading their sections. Some of them, like there were times where Cersei was scheming, and I don't have any great fondness for Cersei, but I was still kind of rooting for her because I thought, oh, that's actually quite. I can see what you're trying to do, and I see all the effort you're putting into it, and I kind of want her to succeed in some ways.
Yeah, I mean that's the mark of really good characterization is the fact that even if you don't like the character, you can't help either being drawn into what is going on with them and wanting to know what happens next, or the fact that you start rooting for them, even though you think, I kind of want to smash your head into a wall, but I also want you to win.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not that I want Cersei to win. I just think that's. I kind of see what you're doing here, and I've been following you, and I kind of want it to succeed. And it's more like I want something to succeed because it was a plan, more than I want Cersei to win. But I
Yeah.
like that because it really does add different dimensions to not only the world, because you get to see all these different places within Westeros, but different societies, different levels, different religions. And all these different periods of what's happening. Because the thing that got me is that book five and book one of book six,
Yeah.
part one of book six, both take place at exactly the same time. And that's mind-blowing.
It's just utterly huge, isn't it? And it is one of those things where you've got a huge sprawling political fantasy epic, and it's not going to be a case of, well, this kingdom over here is going to have nothing. There's going to be no politics. They're not going to do anything. They're not even going to get in the harvest while they sort out their shit in Westeros. It's just not going to happen, is it?
Yeah,
So
no, it's.
that's when it starts to get complicated, and you've really got to be careful when you're pulling on the threads of the timeline.
The other thing I kind of like about Game of Thrones is it sort of makes me think of World War II in particular.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds really random,
But
but it
no,
does.
I'm interested.
No, it really is. It's because it's so much more complex than you initially realize.
Yeah.
And Game of Thrones seems to start off with a sort of a fairly simple premise. Jon Arryn was killed because he discovered Cersei and Jaime were bonking.
Yeah.
And Ned Stark is killed because he discovers it too. And then this whole complicated mess arises where you suddenly go, hold on a second, actually. The Lannisters didn't kill Jon Arryn, and you've got Jon Snow and the Wall, and you've got the people from Dorne and the different politics and the Targaryens, and it just suddenly sort of unravels, and you have all of these different countries and all of these different places which have a which are staking their own claim, and they have a reason to go fighting. And then the interesting thing is that you actually have several countries which can kind of switch sides because they're not loyal to any particular cause or anything like that. They're doing it for their own ends. And I think of, again, of, why did World War II start? We can pinpoint it, people pinpoint, yeah, it was an assassination. But actually, there was a whole bunch of stuff before that.
Yeah, it was a powder keg, ultimately, and
Exactly. And it's the same with Game of Thrones, because it just has all of those different dimensions, and it has all of that history, and you get this sense of no one is guiltless. Everyone has had a part to play in this. Everyone has a history in this. Everyone has their own agenda. And while there may be individuals who are noble, causes that, and even causes which are noble, the overall actually the overall battles and stuff like that, they aren't. And it is about power. And it's just really, really interesting. And I really enjoy it because whilst it also annoys the living daylights out of me, you will get characters in Game of Thrones who will never ever meet each other. And that just it kind of it blows me away a little bit because so often, you know, we have these main sets of characters and eventually they'll all sort of come together. And whilst the main players, as we know, do come together, so Jon Snow and Arya comes home and you know and Clegane and Brienne of Tarth and et cetera, et cetera. There are also these side characters who appear and then die. And it is, you're like, cool, that's a really cool character, but my God, they're never gonna meet Jamie. They're never gonna meet Arya. They were there very briefly, and they had their own lives and their own agency. And there's one particular line I really kind of like in Game of Thrones where initially I can't remember who it is saying to Viserys, oh yes, the whilst they, you know, they bow to the Baratheons in secret, they sow dragon motifs and things like that and pray for the day that the Targaryens return. And then someone said the common folk don't give a damn who's king.
No, they
And
don't.
they really don't give a damn who's king. And you do get that little shot of just ordinary life. And what's happening, and internal politics as well, you know, betrayal within certain courts. And it's just, there's so many levels, and each one is important. You have one level which is just, I'm here to save my brother, you know, and that's all that matters to me. And then you have another level which is, I'm trying to save the entirety of Westeros
Yes.
from monsters. Okay, it's so many different levels, and that is probably why it's so successful, and probably actually why it could never have been made into a movie. It had to be a TV series.
Yeah, it really did. It's far too huge. I mean, they've had to cut quite a lot for the TV series, and even so, it's huger in scope than probably any other similar series that's ever been made. One thing I like that Martin does is the way he plays with reader sympathies, and you touched on this briefly, but we've been re-watching some of the original series, and I haven't read the books for a while now, but you remember that at the very beginning, Jamie was actually kind of a git.
He
He wasn't a
was.
nice character at all. And the thing is, as he goes further on in his character journey and you get further into the story, we start to like him. Because stuff happens to him and he changes, which is good. It's a satisfying character arc. But suddenly going back and looking at the beginning, it's like, no, he's an attempted child murderer. He was utterly feckless and pretty much just only interested in what he liked doing, which, you know, included sleeping with his sister and getting onto a horse to knock other people off with lances and things. You know, he had quite a lot of pride there as well. And that's just one example. It's like, and like nobody, I mean, Ned Stark is the only really, you could say from the start, totally honourable character. And look where that gets him. He doesn't survive the first book.
And interestingly enough, one thing they changed about Robb Stark is obviously in the series he married for love. But in the books he marries for honour because he sleeps with a girl and he says, right, I have to marry her. And thus he dies. And I was kind of on the one side, I understand why they did the married for love. On the other side, I do feel like they missed out one of the main motifs here, which is that Rob is just like his father. And because he encapsulates his father, he is killed.
Yeah, definitely. But something Martin does is he plays with your sympathies as a reader. He starts you off hating a character, and then a couple of books down the line, you'll find out that you are rooting for that character almost above everybody else. And
Yeah.
that's real skill.
It is. The thing with Jamie was when you know the context of what he's actually been through, you can kind of understand some of his childish behavior. And this is going to sound weird and possibly gross, but when we're first introduced to him, he's sleeping with his sister, and I just thought, okay, he's some disgusting pervert. And then you see it from his point of view, and it changed for me when I found out that he genuinely loves her. It's not just a sex, he is genuinely 100% in love with her. And so that stopped being, oh, he's a disgusting pervert, to more like, that's actually really sad. It's really tragic.
I suppose I came in from a position of, well, as long as it's consensual, I don't care who sleeps with who, kind of thing. But yes, it is a squicky thing when you look at it with an unoccluded eye, isn't it?
Yeah.
Initially.
And it was just, and as I said, okay, consensual, like, it's a difficult topic to talk about. But it was just the fact that it just changed actually the way I saw their relationship. Because he is genuinely in love with her. She is his world. And he genuinely does care for her. And he always has. And he doesn't even look at other women.
No.
And that did change things a little bit for me. And it is odd though, because now, looking at it now, can you imagine Jamie repeating? Can you imagine him killing Bran or trying to kill Bran so easily?
Not from where he is now, no.
No.
But then he wasn't that person then, so.
No. So yeah, you're right. George R. R. Martin really does actually play with character sympathies very, very well. And they do creep up on you. And the other thing I like about it is that we didn't see from Jamie's point of view for a very, very long time. And we only ever saw from Ned's point of view. And we trusted Ned, we liked Ned. But Ned was not faultless and he was not perfect.
No, and he made a lot of wrong calls. I
He
mean,
did make a lot of wrong calls.
like a lot of good, decent men, he made a lot of stupid mistakes.
Yeah. And but his our opinion of Jamie was obviously very much colored by the way that he was portrayed, he was seen through Ned's eyes. And obviously also by the fact that he threw Bran out of a window, that is,
That's
a
not
large
something you're
part
going
of
to
it.
get over, really, is
Yeah.
it?
It's quite
As a mother.
difficult. But the fact that Jamie and he was the Kingslayer, and then you have that shopping moment where he turns around, he says, "But I saved everyone in this city because this guy was a madman and he was telling me to attack my own father. And yeah, I sworn to save him, but I stood outside listening to him rape his wife." And I did, and I heard him give orders to just destroy the entire city, to set it on fire. So yeah, I killed him. And you never see it from that point of view until you see it from Jamie's point of view. And I like the way that Martin does that. He just completely flips the perspective in a way that you were certain of something in 1 minute, and then suddenly it just flips.
And that's something that's quite fun to do as an author, which is to set somebody up to be the bad guy and then force your reader to sympathize with them.
Yeah.
Or to at least look at them in a perhaps slightly more sympathetic light. The thing I'm, because obviously the Unveiled series is all in first person, and I've
Yeah.
kept that as a stylistic choice even when I'm writing in different character POVs, which is challenging when it's a voice I haven't necessarily quite got my head around yet. But it's, I suppose, it's quite rewarding, but it's also, I've lost the train of my thought here. This is my cooked brain not doing its best work. Yeah, I wouldn't say it's not really a case of me playing with character on character motivations and reader sympathies so much as there are different things that happen that other characters don't see, and various characters see it very specifically. And you don't have the luxury of being an omnipotent third person narrator if you're doing first person. So, for example, and slight spoilers here, guys, but for example, obviously, at the end of book one, Kieran leaves. And as far as Em knows, at that point in time, it's all this entirely his own decision. And he was leaning that way anyway. But then, if you happen to read Grace's novella, you find out that actually she had a word with him and said, you need to make a decision, kind of like now. I don't really want you hanging around having my sister get more attached to you. So she kind of gives him the final little bit of a shove. And, from Em's point of view, that's a horrible sort of interference. From Kieran's point of view, it's kind of like, no, this isn't all in my own head. This is something I really need to go away and deal with. And from Grace's point of view, it's like, no, you punched my sister in the face. We need, that this is an issue.
Like, he was possessed.
He was, but I will say, as the big sister, that's not the thing that you would just forgive and forget. It's kind of like pushing a child out of a window. It's like, it doesn't matter why you did it. It's kind of like it happened, and unless you promise it's never going to happen again.
And that's the thing, is that, I mean, I think Kieran would have wanted to have promised that it was never ever going to happen again, but he was terrified. Because he'd never want it to happen again, but he suddenly thought, I'm weak. Maybe it will.
Then goes on and leads to various other things happening in other books that perhaps wouldn't have happened at all, or at least wouldn't have happened the way they did if he hadn't have done a bunk in the first place.
I
So
mean,
you get a chain of
there is
events.
that. I was so annoyed with him at the beginning of book two, and he seems to be doing everything wrong, and then you see it from his point of view, and you totally flip the narrative, and you're like, "Oh no, Kieran!"
But you're not a complete time waster.
Oh, baby.
And it's not that the way he does things isn't a mistake, because it is a mistake the way he does it, but why he does it and what he does isn't necessarily a mistake.
No.
And he pays he really pays for the stuff that is a mistake, as in how he goes about delivering what he wants to do.
Yeah. You're horrible to him.
I'm horrible too. I can't say anything, so I'll cause a spoiler for something that's not even out yet, but I'm reminding you of it, and you know what I'm talking about.
Are you talking about my encouragement or the fan fictions I've written where I've done horrible things to him?
Well, both, but certainly the I think you need to add one more line.
Oh, yes. Well, if you're going to make him suffer, you might as well go all the way. You guys can all look forward to that. Anyway.
It's sort of something you do with Zachary, I think, because in the first book, Zachary's not that sympathetic.
No, he's a bit of a dick, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, he's not an out and out monster, but you don't get any sense that he might be one of the good guys either.
And that's largely because when you do see it from his point of view, Zachary at this point in time has decided that he's going to be a monster. It's the role he's basically, he says, right, I'm the villain of this story because I need to be. Because it'll save everybody else. So he's decided to do the bad things for the sake of what he ultimately thinks is going to be the good. Which means that he says and thinks a lot of very nasty things. But when you actually look at what he does, it's quite contrary. And I think one of my favorite examples of it is he makes this flower crown. And he goes home and he sees his housekeeper, Heather Benson. And he says, don't wake me until it's time for me to kill someone. And then he puts this flower crown on her head. And the flowers basically are a gift that one gives one's mother. So he's made this thing, it's this very tender gift of saying, I want you to know I love you. And it's a very sweet thing for him to do, but it's completely contrasted by the violent language and imagery that he himself uses. And it's only when you kind of get to see it later on, you find out actually what was going on with him. And I mean, everyone's always on the Delphi side, but I still get messages from Gareth who says that he hasn't forgiven Torrin Merle for what he did. And really, yeah, both sides have done some pretty bad things, and no one is right, and it's just about this struggle. And I even feel sorry for Rhaen. There's only one character in the entirety of Maegmel who's a villain, and that's De Giles. Who
To be
just
fair, he needs to die.
he does need to die. And maybe he will, or maybe he won't. We'll see.
Was such a tease.
But I wrote Blood, Teeth, and Bones, which is a short novella set during Book Two. For those who've read Blood of the Delphi, there's a small section where Zachary takes ill. And you see it from his point of view, where he's just walking up the stairs one minute and then he trips. And as he's falling, he goes, "Oh Christ, I do have a fever. I hate fevers." And he doesn't remember anything else until he wakes up about 3 days later, where he has a conversation with Isolde, and they say, "Oh yeah, you were asleep." He goes, "Oh, wasn't that bad then." And then Blood, Teeth, and Bones looks at it from Marcel's point of view, and what all of the characters went through when he was sick, because he almost died, and he isn't very aware of this, but how bad he actually got. He had a sleep fever, and you see also the way that Marcel looks at the king, and the way that Marcel looks at Isolde. And Isolde is a difficult one because, quite frankly, she groomed Zachary from a very young age, and she essentially did rape him when he was about 17 years old, because he didn't really want to have sex, but she sort of insisted, and she did groom him, but he was totally in love with her, so he never recognized her abusive behavior, and he will never sort of think, he will never acknowledge the fact that it was sexual assault and sexual abuse, because it's him, so he won't. And it's the first time that that's really actually not just implied, but stated as a fact, that this was something that happened. And you only will ev only ever see that from an outside point of view. So I also like playing with people's expectations of characters and the way that people see them, because I am also very conscious of the fact that from another point of view, my God, Rufus could be terrifying as a villain. He would be a very scary villain.
Yeah, definitely.
So
That
yeah.
might be a fun one. Oh no, don't give me ideas for Unveiled. So like, actually, if you think about some of the things M does, and it's kind of like from someone else's point of view.
Yeah,
You're not really a
she's
monster, but
scary.
you have moments when you're like the third Phoenix, you know?
Yeah. Oh man, I want to do this. She's a nightmare, and Kestrel as well. Kestrel is very scary. And actually, there is a bit in the second book where they do see her as the villain. Not her friends, a group of witches that she stops. They see her as a villain, and they get very scared of her. And
Well, to be fair, if they're witches, I can understand why they might think that about Kestrel.
Kestrel's not very nice to them, but then they do curse her. So you know, it's two sides to this. Kestrel's slightly abrupt nature, and a few idle threats are taken a little bit more seriously than they should have been. So. But yeah, I think that's the important thing, is that it's good to remember not only that A, everyone is the hero of their own story, but also remember that to your main character, to somebody else, is the villain.
Yeah.
So it's always good to take a step back and say how, and in what way could they be an antagonistic figure?
Yes. And sometimes it's actually helps inform your writing if you perhaps write a little scene from that point of view whereby your character appears as the villain, because it will all feed, you might never show it to anybody, or you might do what Madeline and I do and turn it into a series of books.
An experiment turns into a novella.
It just takes over. I mean, it's a really good job we never decided to reanimate the dead, because can you imagine what the world would be like? It's like, it would be like The Sorcerer's Apprentice, except we'd have hundreds of thousands of these ruddy corpses rather than brooms with buckets.
Oh my god, Jules!
Anyway, sidebar.
I like your thinking.
We're not going to reanimate the dead, just to be clear. But yeah, you know, just that scene from another character's point of view will help inform your writing. I wrote a number of scenes from Hayes's point of view when I first wrote I Belong to the Earth, because it helped cement the character.
Mm.
So even though you only really ever see him from M's point of view, he's not never a flat, two-dimensional villain, because you get these flashes of humanity, because I know why he did what he did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... Yeah, as one reader and reviewer said, cool motive, still murder. Brooklyn 999. But those sort of scenes and things, the little extra bits that you write, which may or may not completely take over your life, do actually help. So it's not a case of I ever set out to write lots of multiple points of view.
It just sort of happened, didn't it?
Do you know when it happened? When I was writing book two, and I was so stuck on that book, and I needed to know what happened in between. So I thought I'd write a scene from Grace's point of view, and then I suddenly had a novella, and I'm like, oh, I wonder what happens if I write from Amy's point of view. Three novellas later, I was like, yeah, this is apparently a thing.
It was also the fact that you suddenly went, oh, it'd be interesting to write this scene from Kieran's point of view. And now you're rewriting the...
That's a secret project, Madeline.
Sorry.
In all fairness, that won't be a book. It really won't. I know I've said this before, but it really won't be a book.
You've said this twice before, and every time I have corrected you. And I'm saying it again. This is going to be a book.
Third time lucky. Anyway,
Kieran's going to surprise you.
He's already surprised me, to be honest. That wasn't entirely my fault, because anyway, there was a vote on my newsletter as to what they wanted as a freebie on my birthday. So I wrote that scene and then realised I had a bunch of other scenes from his perspective from that book. And then it's like, I'm actually kind of interested in how these connect up.
Yeah.
And Madeline, being the sensible friend she is, said, no, Jules, don't do that. You have other projects planned.
That's a lie. I didn't do that. I said, go for it, Jules. Because I'm an enabler.
I'm glad you recognise that.
You're not much better. Jules has already threatened to hide, to lock me up in her basement so that I'll write more Kestrel.
And so that you understand the level of dedication, I don't have a basement yet, but I'm willing to put some work into it. We have a big garden.
Oh.
So if you don't hear from Madeline for a while, she's definitely not locked up in my new basement. Wheel her out for Dissecting Dragons episodes.
I send out coded messages.
I'm happy. I'm really happy.
I'm really, really happy. All I see is darkness. Anyway.
Moving along from that scary thought, let's look at dual timelines whereby they were deliberately set up to be dual timelines from the very beginning, and you don't let the reader in on knowing that from the start. So it's almost like you're writing a book from the middle outwards.
Yeah.
And as far as the reader or the viewer knows, the timelines are happening at the same time or divided by years. And I suppose one of the things, you know, divided by years, but they don't necessarily you're not sure how they're connected to each other until you get right to the end.
Yeah.
And a good example is Westworld. Did you ever watch any of that?
I didn't know. It's too scary for me.
Some spoilers, I'm afraid, guys, but Westworld is a series that Netflix, which is basically adapted from a Michael Crichton novel of the same name, mm-hmm. whereby a huge theme park is set up where everything is in, you know, the mythical Wild West. And it was supposed to be this beautiful sort of paradise where people could go and just be somebody else for a little while. But it turned out that what people really wanted to do is get in there and commit murder and rape and do all the things that you can't do in real life. So it's kind of like people modding games so that they can do whatever they want in them, which is quite disturbing, obviously, if you think about it. But these are robots. These are androids that are programmed. And whenever you've got AI, at some point you have the potential of the AI becoming actual artificial intelligence, indistinguishable under the Turing test, whereby they're alive, effectively.
Yeah.
And we've been using them as slaves and abusing them for all this time, forcing them to do unspeakable things and endure unspeakable things. And they're kind of pissed off, understandably.
Yeah.
But the way Westworld does the timelines, you have a young guy who's just arriving at Westworld as part of joining this new, you know, it's kind of like a bachelor's party,
mm-hmm.
where he goes with some friends of the new family that he's marrying into. And it's a big sort of crime syndicate type family, which is why they're getting such an expensive bachelor party.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes rogue. He gets so involved in Westworld that he just disappears off into the wilderness. And on the other timeline, you've got the old guy who created the park, and you're told that this one robot is the oldest one in the park. I mean, she doesn't look it, but then she's a robot.
Yeah.
And it's that same robot that he forms such a, that the young guy on the other timeline forms such a profound connection with. And on the second timeline, there is also the guy who is very definitely a black hat, as in literally wears a black hat.
Mm-hmm.
And he does some of the worst atrocities and things that you see initially, and it's only as you get to the end of the series that you start to get suspicious about how it like intersects, and the robots are waking up and they're becoming self-aware, and they are sending that awareness to each other. You know, they're up for slyly organizing, they're enduring things now because they're biding their time. It's mm-hmm. it's quite sinister. And when you get to the end of the first season, you realise that the young guy is the black hat.
Ah.
And there is a gap between those two timelines. You realise finally that it's the young guy is in the past and this black hat is in the future, and something terrible has happened in the middle, but you don't really get to find out exactly what that is. So it's very deliberately told on those two dual timelines in the series.
Yeah.
Which could go horribly wrong. You could end up with a situation where your reader feels cheated, but I think worked in that particular instance.
I'm trying to think of another good example of another show which has done something similar, and I do have one, but I don't actually remember what it is, but I have this great sense of kind of, oh yeah, that's a good, but I can't figure out what it is. That sounds really dumb.
Yeah, I mean, I think it works best where there's a sense of there's a mystery to be solved.
Yeah.
And you can do it, obviously, like I suppose I have, whereby you've very definitely got things happening in the past and you don't know how they relate to what's happening in the future or the present at that point in time. Or you can do it quite subtly, as in Westworld, whereby perhaps there's only like 40 years dividing the two timelines, and so it's not enough of a difference for you to know that they're different timelines even.
Yeah.
But that it's still a case of this is solving a mystery.
Yeah.
I think they kind of did it a bit with Legion.
Yes, okay, so that's what I was thinking. Legion. Thank you for sorting out my mind.
That's okay.
Legion is interesting because he's an unreliable narrator.
Yes.
And so the first episode of Legion, I hated it. I couldn't understand what was going on. It was far too weird for me because it was really difficult to tell what was happening at what point.
Yeah.
And there were these very fragmented pieces of what was reality and what was fiction. And Legion does jump backward and forward in kind of much the same way. And this is an interesting, it isn't quite the same, but I watched the early seasons of Lost, and I don't know if you ever watched those.
Yeah, the first couple of seasons.
And something interesting that they did was that they actually proved that all of the characters who were on the island were interconnected in different ways
Yeah.
in their past, but not necessarily knowingly.
Yeah, they'd kind of crossed paths, hadn't they, a lot of them.
Or there was links, so one actually met one's father and things like that.
Yeah.
And this was all discovered through flashbacks.
Yeah.
And I really liked that because it was the added level of what was happening in the past and what was happening in the present completely changed the context of the relationships on the island. And I really enjoyed that. And there was this real sense of mystery of kind of why people behaved in a certain way. And I really appreciated the way that time was used in that. And it also makes me think of there was a book called Witch Child,
Yeah.
which I read when I was younger, and there was a sequel, which is actually follows the same character from Witch Child, but also follows a Native American woman many years in the future who's researching the story.
Yes.
And it kind of jumps between the two. And I never actually finished it because I think I had to return it to the library and I couldn't get it out again. But it was I think I'd really appreciate it now. But I think probably the best version of a story which jumps between times like that has got to be The Time Traveler's Wife.
Yeah, and as you say, that's told from one point of view on various different timelines, ultimately. And I think it's a bit of an act of faith. Mark Lawrence does something similar in King of Thorns. He uses one character point of view and in first person, but you are very definitely on two different timelines. And he doesn't tell you, he trusts you to keep up. And he said himself when he was asked about it that it was a gamble on his reader's intelligence, and by and large, it paid off. And I think the same thing happened with Audrey Niffenegger's The Time Traveler's Wife as well, because you are leaping backwards and forwards through time, and nothing's linear. It's not a linear plot at all, by its very nature, and you're expected to keep up as a reader. And when that works, that really works. But I think you've got to have a fair bit of skill to pull it off, haven't you?
You do, because it's about making sure that it's still it's intriguing enough. Your readers will actually sit through the mystery,
Yeah.
and that you slowly give out pieces in a manner which is satisfying and timely, whilst also not being too obvious.
Yeah, and yet still sticking to the scrambled up timelines, which is no easy feat. I mean, if you think about it, we're with Kestrel and Unveiled, we're just trying to organise basically one timeline that just has little offshoots, not like six or seven different timelines that happen simultaneously. And that's still a massive, massive scramble.
It is a scramble. But yet it will get more difficult when the dimension hopping comes into it.
Yeah, it's a good job that M is very specific to the place when she does her dimension hopping.
Kestrel can pretty much fall into any world.
That sort of brings us, I think, to a natural closing point.
It does. But before we go, obviously, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, it's Jules' recommendation, and it does actually have to do with the topic. So, Jules, tell us about it.
It does. It was last Friday, I think. Alan and I watched this really great anime film that he'd heard about on a podcast called Your Name. And it's by Makoto Shinkai, who is being lauded as the next Miyazaki of like Studio Ghibli type fame. And it's amazing. It's really, really good. It does make use of the dual timelines. And I don't want to say too much about it because basically you've kind of got to go in a little bit blind to get the most out of it. But it is about a boy who lives in Tokyo and a girl who lives in one of the more rural towns in Japan. And they start dreaming about each other in the sense of not seeing each other, but dreaming that they're seeing through each other's eyes. And then they realize that they're body swapping. So they go to sleep and they wake up in the other one's body. So they keep, it has sort of happens two or three times a week. And they end up really getting to know each other this way, because I think you probably would.
Yeah.
And it goes on from there. It's quite a convoluted plot, but it's never too difficult to follow. The anime is absolutely gorgeous, and the story is utterly heart-wrenching. As I said, I don't want to spoil it. There was a point halfway through where I was kind of like, I want to rage quit now because I'm so upset. As in furious upset. But don't do that. If you get to that point, just power on through. And it's a really, really good film. And it does do all the things that we've been talking about in this episode. It plays with your sympathies. It's multiple points of view and it plays with timelines.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, it's already been on my list for a while now, but you've really
boosted up there.
Yeah.
It's unusual that I don't recommend a book, really, isn't it?
But it is unusual that you don't recommend a book. The world is turning upside down.
It's the heat. It is the heat.
And on that note, guys, we'll catch you next week, and thanks very much for listening.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.